Good evening, everybody. Let's begin the evening's review of Mind Training Like Rays of the Sun with motivation. So today we have at the Abbey here celebrated the first turning of the Wheel of the Dharma by the Buddha. And so realizing the rarity of first the Buddha appearing in our world. Secondly, of him choosing to not go into the bliss of nirvana, but to remain in our world and to teach. And for us, for our however many lifetimes it took to create the causes and conditions to be born during the time where a Buddha has taught, where the teachings are still pure and vital, shared by qualified Mahayana teachers. So let's just take this day as a symbol of the preciousness and the rarity of our opportunity to cultivate not only all of our good qualities and work very sincerely and fervently on abandoning the negativities that bring suffering, so that we can eventually liberate ourselves from this cycle of birth, aging, sickness, and death. But as the Buddha did, because of his great compassion and his bodhicitta, or his awakening mind, he decided to stay with us now and until every one of us is liberated. And so let's use him as an example and to set our motivation vast to awaken ourselves through the practice of his teachings so that we can attain Buddhahood, because that is going to be the best state in which we can truly benefit all sentient beings. And so we have met the Dharma, we have had and shown interest, we practice as best as we can, and we have wonderful qualified teachers to guide us. And so let's use these rare treasures of opportunity wisely for the benefit of all beings. So while Venerable has been away receiving teachings from a very wonderful qualified spiritual teacher, we're reviewing the Mind Training Like Rays of the Sun, and tonight I have the wonderful opportunity of reviewing Cultivating the Conventional Awakening Mind, at least the first part of it. It's a very extensive part of the book, and Venerable spent many, many months on it. So I will do my best to try to give you the high points as well as I understand them. So the first part was in this section of the book is the clarifying the two bodhicittas. So this is the conventional bodhicitta, which is the aspiration in order to benefit sentient beings as well as we can. We want to obtain Buddhahood. And then the other is the ultimate bodhicitta, and in fact it's not a bodhicitta. It's the wisdom realizing emptiness. So this section that I'm reviewing tonight is going to be concerned with the conventional bodhicitta, this wonderful aspiration to attain enlightenment for the welfare of all beings. And so the actual techniques for cultivating this awakening mind, this is where, as in a lot of Tibetan texts, there's divisions and there's subdivisions and there's points under those subdivisions. So bear with me as I try to line them out as best as I can. So the instructions for actually training in conventional bodhicitta have two subdivisions. The first one is the process of cultivating the awakening mind that is concerned with the welfare of sentient beings. And the other one is the process of cultivating the awakening mind concerned with attaining full awakened state of being. So this is basically the definition of bodhicitta. So underneath the first subdivision, the one concerned with the welfare of others, there are two subpoints. The first one is exchanging yourself with others by seeing the disadvantages of selfishness and the advantages of cherishing others. And then the second one is actually cultivating the awakened mind that is concerned with the interest of others. So before Venerable got into this very deep, profound teaching on equalizing, exchanging self and others with all of its points, She took a little detour and spent some time on the seven-point instruction of cause and effect, which is another way to generate bodhicitta. There are these two main practices, the equalizing and exchanging self and others, of which Nam Kapel spends the major part of the middle of this book, commentaries on, Nishantideva. And then there is the seven-point instruction of cause and effect, which is another practice to generate bodhicitta, of which I have found over the years of doing my best to practice it, it actually has helped me to understand the more I find more difficult one of equalizing, exchanging self and others. So I'm just going to go over these very quickly. It's a wonderful practice. I have found it extremely helpful. It has 7 points. 6 of them are causes, and the seventh one is an effect. And the preliminary practice, even before you get into the 7 points, is the meditation on equanimity. And this is the one that I have found to be the most powerful and the most consistent, and the one that has helped me to start dismantling the self-centered thought within my own mind. And it is the practice that helps to stabilize love and compassion, because one of the things that happens when we don't have any equanimity is that the self-centered thought, this is its main pastime, is to put people into boxes, friend, enemy, and stranger, according to how they treat me, take care of me, criticize me, care for me, pay attention to me. So the self-centered thought uses putting people into boxes, which then causes a lot of disharmony in our relationships, a lot of suffering for ourselves and others. So the practice of equanimity, because the self-centered thought, as we'll find out tonight, is the main culprit, the main obstacle for generating bodhicitta, that the practice of equanimity stabilizes the mind so it's not going up and down all day long, putting people into, you're my friend, 15 minutes later, you're my enemy, oh yeah, I don't care, you're a stranger. It gets the mind calmed down, it gets it stable, and it also gets us to see that sentient beings are not friend, enemy, and stranger from their own side. That it's a lot of the way in which our crazy minds make up things depending on how they relate to us. So the practice of equanimity is the preliminary to the seven-point instruction of cause and effect. So as we start to tear down the categories of friend, enemy, and stranger, then things really open up between us and others. Our hearts open up, we soften, we give them a lot more space to be who they are. We're a lot less attached to what other people think. And so then, looking at the 7 points that are in the 7-point cause and effect, they don't seem to be so impossible because we've got more of a balanced mind that's got more tolerance, more love, more understanding of others. So the 7-point instruction starts with seeing all sentient beings as having been our mothers or parents, whatever is more comfortable. The second one is thinking of their kindness, which for some of us is a really powerful practice because those of us who have had somewhat difficult childhoods, this is a wonderful practice to understand that there was a lot of kindness, the fact that we're alive and well today due to their kindness, and that it also helps us to get over the point about using the way that we were raised as excuses for our bad behavior, excuses for the afflictions that arise in our minds. We're depressed, we're angry, we're pissed off, we're emotionally unstable, we're resentful, insecure because of our parents. So this is a very powerful, particularly these first three about thinking of our parents and their kindness. The third one is because of the kindness, we wish to repay it. And this, you really need a very, very big view to see how is the best way that I can repay the kindness of not only the parents of this life, but of all sentient beings who have been parents in past lives. Then the fourth one is heartwarming love, which is seeing these sentient beings who have been our parents as see them in beauty, see them with a sense of warmth and closeness. Following that is compassion, and then the great resolve, and then finally the effect, which is bodhicitta. So this is a beautiful practice when you're feeling kind of complaining and whining and sort of sorry for yourself and feeling like your mind's gotten really tight. This is a wonderful practice to generate, to open up the heart and open up the mind. So after that, then Venerable went on to the main subdivision in this section on conventional bodhicitta, which is exchanging yourself with others through acknowledging the faults of selfishness and the advantages of concern for others. So this is the training that follows Shanti Deva's tradition. This is the one that his whole Guide to a Bodhisattva's Way of Life, big portions of that are looking at some of the points that we'll go over tonight. So, however, at this point, Venerable says, well, before we can actually do that practice of seeing the disadvantages of self-centeredness and the advantages of cherishing others, we've got to practice and meditate on equalizing self and others. We've got to get ourselves on a little bit more of a level playing field with the rest of sentient beings. So this meditation is, once again, divided into points. You've got 9 points total, 3 sets of 3. The first 2 sets look at things from a conventional point of view, and then the third set of 3 look at things from an ultimate point of view. Within the first set, there are 3 points that look at the conventional point of view in relationship to others. The second one is in relationship to self, and then the third one is the ultimate view. So this is I also really love this meditation. So the first one, which on one level it sounds like a no-brainer, but it's probably one of the most profound teachings that I've ever heard in the Dharma, and His Holiness, this is his, there was a slogan of His Holiness, this would be it, is everybody wants happiness and nobody wants to suffer. So this is, no matter which sentient beings, we all want the same thing equally. From the smallest insect to the largest animal to the most brilliant sentient being, in all the realms, no matter what level of suffering, no matter what level of happiness, we all want to be free of suffering and we all want happiness equally. Now we all know it, but we forget it in all of our life situations. This is something that is very simple to understand intellectually and very profound to realize. The second point in this one regards to others is the example of the 10 beggars, or in this culture I tend to use homeless. We don't usually call our folks that on the streets beggars, but in India they do, who also want happiness, so discriminating against them is unfair. So this analogy in particular is when you think of people who are beggars and homeless on the street, they all have particular needs to be happy, whether it's food, shelter, clothing, someone to talk to, maybe they need some hospitalization, they need some care for their minds, care for their bodies, they could be sick. No matter what their needs are, they all want to be happy. And why is it that our mind in some way sees some of them worthy of our attention and favor and some that aren't worthy of our favor and attention? They all equally want to be happy. The third point is the analogy of patients. So you go to a hospital and you see all the suffering. You see somebody that's come in from a car accident, somebody who's having a hernia operation, somebody who's got cancer, somebody who's fainted at work and nobody knows why. They're in, you know, the emergency room. Their main focus is what's causing the suffering and how can it be alleviated within myself. And once again, to watch our minds on how do we see that some of those, it would be like being a doctor and going into these patients' rooms and deciding which ones get treatment and which ones don't. Since everybody wants to be free of suffering, the mind that favors one over the other is irrational and doesn't make any sense. So those first three are in relation to others. The second set, looking at conventionally the viewpoint of oneself, is first of all, another profound statement that we can, I think, understand very conventionally but is very difficult to realize, is that all sentient beings have been kind to us. So we helped them all. And it's the understanding that who we are, what we have, the skills that we have are in complete dependence on others. That there is nothing about the good conditions of our life, any form of happiness that we have, that does not come in relationship to the kindness that we have received from other sentient beings. And the second point in this one is, if you think that you've been harmed by these sentient beings, remember that the help that they have given you far exceeds the harm. And this one is in regards to the fact that patience is one of the most important virtues to cultivate if we're going to become a Buddha. Because when we're Buddha, we deal with sentient beings all the time. And that those that harm us give us the wonderful opportunity to practice patience. And chances are that those that have harmed us have not always been our enemy, have not always harmed us. They have been friends in the past. They will be strangers in the future. And during those times, they have given us unbelievable kindness. The third one is that since we are all going to die, there is no sense in holding grudges, looking for revenge. And this is one that if you want to make yourself miserable, just hold a grudge. Just think about retaliating against some harm that's been done. So what happens with holding a grudge and wanting to retaliate is that we create a lot of negative karma, which, you know, I've had a few grudges in my life. They have luckily been fairly short-lived, and I've been working very hard at letting them go. But the mind that grudge holds is an angry mind, a hostile mind, a resentful mind. And what happens is we habituate that mind to all of our lives. So at the time of death, if there's this mind is going on and it arises, it can throw us into a very unfortunate rebirth. So this is the kind of mind that you don't want to have. So holding grudges is one of the greatest causes for future suffering that we know as sentient beings. Then the last set is the third set is the reasoning that's based on the ultimate truth. So this is where we get emptiness in the perspective. And the first one is that if friend, enemy, and strangers were real, inherently existent from their own side as our mind perceives them, then the Buddha would also see them as such. But since the Buddha, who is omniscient and doesn't have one single consciousness that's mistaken, we have to go along with his omniscient mind's reasoning and know that that's not true, because the Buddha does not see any sentient beings as friend, enemy, and stranger. In fact, there's a lot of stories in the sutra that talk about his dealings with people that we would label friend, enemy, and strangers. I mean, he had Devadatta to deal with most of his life, his cousin who continually tried to cause schism in the Sangha or kill him. Angulimala, who was a murderer, who was going to kill him. His dear disciples, Shariputra and Ananda, and then the number of strangers that he had in his life. And all the sutras that talk about his relationship, when he meets each of these sentient beings, he treats them with the same love, the same compassion, the same wisdom, with the individual skillful means depending on their dispositions. But there's never any place in the sutras where you see the Buddha pointing people out and putting them into these categories. And so I trust the Buddha that there are no such beings that exist, and that is just a fabrication of my crazy mind and my self-centered. The second point under this is that if friend, enemy, and strangers were inherently existent, they would always be that. So our friends, despite how badly they behaved, no matter whether they hated us, disappeared out of our lives, they would always be friends. Strangers would always be strangers. Enemies would always be enemies. And there would be no opportunity for them to grow, change. They could leave our lives and they would always be friends. I mean, just the logic of it doesn't make any sense. So the fact that people change moment by moment, that our relationships change with them, that nobody can be a permanent friend, an inherently existent friend, enemy, or stranger. And then the third one, which is the one that really brings equalizing self and others, is that if discriminating between self and others, if self and others were inherently existent, then you could say that I am more important because I am inherently I, and you are less important because you are inherently other. But we can... But that can't be the case because self and others depend on each other. So in other words, we can't identify self without identifying other, and other can't be identified without depending on self. And so this whole thing, it feels like there's only one I and everybody else is other, but if you talk to any person in the world, they're I and you're other. So they're mere labels depending on perspective. So there are countless others, countless eyes, moving in and out relationship to each other all day long. So we can't, so exchanging ourselves for others, all you do is just change the perspective. And that is just exchange where you label I because you realize that I is merely labeled and the other is merely labeled. So this is where the leveling of the field of who we cherish really gets played out. This is a very difficult, I find this a challenge to understand, but I'm understanding it a little bit better from studying this the past few weeks. Okay, so the next point then, okay, so that's the equalizing self and other. So at this point, the mind is getting a little bit stable, understanding that the self-centered thought and the fabrications are causing a lot of this inequality between self and others, and that through this meditation you start bringing all sentient beings more into the possibility of actually cherishing them, actually caring about them, having heartwarming love and compassion for them, because you see that they are wanting to be happy and not suffer in all the ways that are explained here. So then we can take on the task of contemplating the disadvantages of self-centeredness. And the slogan that goes with this part of the teaching is, banish the one to blame for everything. So the cause of all of our suffering is the self-centered thought. So, as His Holiness says, is that if you want to be selfish, be wisely selfish, cherish others. And just developing this understanding is hard, because since the beginningless time, we've had it totally turned around, saying that the self-centered thought has been our best friend, and that cherishing others is what causes us suffering. So we've got everything sort of upside down. And that we don't see the self-centered thought as the cause for all of our problems. We see other sentient beings as the cause for all of our problems. So then there's this question, but then we say, well, no wonder we've been wandering around in cyclic existence since the beginning of time, because this is how we think. So when we get into the point of where we don't get anywhere with our practice, our mind is restless, our mind is bored, we're not feeling like we're getting anywhere, we don't go to the questions of, well, why is that happening? Why am I restless? Why am I discontent? The first place we go is outside of ourselves. That's where the self-centered thought wants us to go. So we need to really investigate our experience, seeing where the afflicted states of mind come. And at this point here, when I was reading Venerable's teaching on this, I keep thinking of, I used to love mystery novels and mystery movies, those whodunits, you know, Sherlock Holmes and Columbo and Poirot, and for us old-timers, Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys, Columbo. And you have to be sort of like a detective, because the self-centered thought wears all sorts of disguises, and that what you need to do is you need to investigate who is the thief that steals our joy, who is the killer of our happiness, who did it, who's to blame, and how do we go about catching them. And so one of the ways in which we do that is that we go into the sort of this detective sort of thinking, and we go and we investigate in our minds and ask the questions. You know, where are these afflicted states of mind coming from? Where does our happiness come from? Where does our suffering come from? And through a course of investigating, we find out that the external world has very little to do. There are sometimes cooperative conditions that support what's happening in our minds, but the main source of our suffering and happiness is from our own minds. And that the self-centered thought is indeed the center of all that trouble. And so it's very important to remember that the self-centered mind, the self-centered thought, is not who we are. And this is probably one of the most difficult understandings of this practice of equalizing, exchanging self and others, is that we are not the self-centered attitude. And unless we understand that and separate the conventional I, who wants to be happy, who doesn't want to suffer, who cultivates good qualities, tries to abandon the negative qualities, generate bodhicitta, who works very hard, goes from life to life, that conventional self is very different than this particular deluded attitude which arises due to the self-grasping ignorance. And if we can start to sort of untangle ourselves from this misunderstanding, that's when we can start working on identifying how it is very much the thief that steals our happiness and the killer of our joy. So Shantideva has a quote that kind of sums it up. However much torment, fear, and suffering there is in the world, it all arises from the misconception of self. Oh, what trouble this great ghost brings me. So that is indeed the self-centered thought, the great ghost. So if we're able to really see the self-centeredness as the enemy, all right, but that's the one who gets in the way of our happiness, and we start applying the antidotes of the Dharma, that no matter what happens on the outside, the mind can cultivate a kind of stability, a kind of courage, a compassion, a wisdom that can discern the self-centered thought from the sentient being who wants to be happy and not suffer. But if you don't see the self-centered thought as your enemy, even things like our good qualities, they end up getting undermined and become sort of the causes for a certain level of conceit and arrogance and pride, which are also not beneficial to our mind. And this takes a lot of introspection, it takes a lot of time, a lot of patience, humor, compassion, wisdom. But over time, the self-centered thought, we learn to identify it. And for me, I can tell sometimes the self-centered thought, there's a particular flavor in the mind that's very different than Semkhe. It's got a tightness, a whininess, a narrowness, a suspicion. There's definitely a flavor to it. And when my mind goes in that place, I know that it's time to bring up the introspective alertness to start asking the questions about what's going on. And to be very clear that we're not trying to blame ourselves, feel guilty, criticize ourselves. It's all around discovering where the self-centered thought is and starting to work on disempowering it from our mind. So what is it to be put into practice through contemplating the advantage of concern for others? So once we identify the cause of our happiness, and well, our happiness is our good qualities, the suffering that we have is due to the self-centered thought. Once we identify the cause of our suffering as a self-centered thought, and we take the responsibility of that off of sentient beings, then the possibility of seeing the advantages of cherishing them starts to arise, because we've taken away all the blame, we've taken a lot of the criticism, the harshness, the paranoia, the retaliating away from the external world, and we start thinking about them in a much different kind of view, because they're not out to get us all the time. So meditating on the great kindness of all beings is a very important meditation. It's for our own spiritual progress. It helps us to cultivate love and compassion, which are crucial at the beginning of the path, the middle of the path, and at the end of our practice. And that love and compassion are not generated in a vacuum. They are generated solely on our relationship to sentient beings. All these wonderful qualities that help us to generate bodhicitta. Sentient beings are the main cause for why we have these wonderful qualities. So rather than seeing sentient beings as nuisances because they get in our way, we see that our spiritual development depends on them. So it's not only they build our roads and they produce our food and they make our clothes, but they also help us progress along the path because they help us to cultivate all of our good qualities and help us to learn to abandon the qualities that harm and the qualities that cause suffering. So Lama Zopa says, your enlightenment depends on each and every sentient being. Even if you leave one sentient being out, you cannot generate bodhicitta. And that enlightenment must be preceded by love and compassion. So they are the causes for bodhicitta. Sort of the fuel for enlightenment. So when I came to this part of the teaching, I had to laugh because Venerable got into, this is great view. So in other words, we can't get into some spiritually isolated state where we think that spirituality is different than caring for sentient beings. And it's that craving that we have some kind of spiritual state that's going to take us away from all of those pain in the next sentient beings, give us some quiet, solitude, peace, away from them. So I can really cultivate love, compassion, bodhicitta. And, you know, this is very helpful for me to look at because it's been getting so wonderfully busy at the Abbey. We have so many people coming because they want to be here. They want to learn. They want to be with us, live in community. And sometimes my little self-centered mind just wants a little space. But if I'm going to become a Buddha, I have to love and care for them and really want them to be here because I depend on them for my enlightenment. So as much as sometimes a walk in the woods is helpful, I've been using this in this particular because I've been kind of tired and we've had a lot of folks here, and I'm saying my enlightenment depends on them. And I'm so glad that they're here because I cannot be enlightened without them. Now, it's not to say that you have to think of sentient beings all the time, because evidently when you get into these deeper states of samadhi and you realize emptiness directly, the wisdom realizing emptiness is superior in your mind. There's no thought of sentient beings. However, sentient beings are the cause to help you to get that state, to get to that state, as well as samadhi. All of the cherishing of sentient beings, cultivating this beautiful mind of love and compassion, patience, it opens up the mind and makes the mind very receptive to gaining realizations and insights. So then later on down the path, samadhi, the wisdom realizing emptiness, they get fertile ground to actually be able to arise in our minds, because the ground is so fertile with all of this wonderful love and compassion. It's single-pointed concentration when you've got yourself focused on a virtuous object to the point where there's a generate a lot of bliss in your mind, and all the afflictions are very much subdued. They're not eliminated, but they're pretty much out of the mind. So you're not thinking of sentient beings at the time because your mind's in this very clear, blissful state. So sentient beings, we are dependent upon them for our enlightenment. And what's really cool about it is that when we become Buddhas, enlightened activity also depends on sentient beings. So we have them in our lives from now until eternity. Okay, so then, venerable in her wisdom, because she knows that some of us have black and white thinking, so she says, it's important to remember that cherishing others does not mean that you do what everybody wants. Because then we swing to the other side, says, well, if I'm going to generate bodhicitta and I'm going to all the kindness, then I just, you know, do whatever anybody wants me to do. And this is where she says that if you're going to, you know, generate love and compassion in your mind, make sure that you've got some wisdom along with it, so that you can look at sentient beings, and by cultivating wisdom, you can actually figure out to the best of your ability what you can do to benefit them. You know, rather than giving them, what is she said that you don't want to, you know, we really have to think about suffering not as just somebody's dissatisfied mind and fulfilling that dissatisfied mind, but to think about what is it that I can do to benefit them in the long run. So there's a lot of wisdom that has to be cultivated simultaneously as we're trying to cultivate love, compassion, and bodhicitta. Or else we're going to just be making a lot of suffering and problems because we're not using any type of wisdom. So then the question comes up, once again, venerable in her wisdom. She says, well, then what happens when we've got sentient beings in our lives that are that have a lot of negative states of mind, and they're cruel and they're obnoxious and they harm people? You know, cherishing them sounds like a difficult task. So this is where we have to practice patience with them, which means we don't just stuff our feelings and put a smile on our face and, you know, just mistreat me, thank you very much. That we're really trying to see that sentient beings are kind, yet at the same time they're under the control of their afflictions. And this is a very important thing to remember, because we want people to be tolerant and patient and kind with us when we're under the control of our afflictions. And so it's the same thing that we want to do for them, is that when they're having a hard time under the control of their own afflictions and karma, is that we're also being tolerant and patient and trying to see their kindness, at the same time realizing that they're just, you know, right now suffering. And so compassion gets generated instead of resentment, anger, paranoia. And by going through these practices of cherishing others and the disadvantages of self-centeredness, these practices start giving us an internal strength to be able to deal with our own afflictions, to be able to generate good qualities. And they also help us to not step back into our old habits. because what happens as we start being more mindful of our relationship to sentient beings and how kind they've been and the disadvantages of self-centeredness is that the Dharma becomes little by little more the state of our mind on a daily basis. So it's not just there in the beginning of the day, but it actually starts to arise a little bit more frequently. It's a little bit more stable. And that we remember the Dharma all the time in every situation and use it as an opportunity to train our mind rather than to have a self-centered thought come up and take over and cause all sorts of trouble. So we've got to see these practices as a way to really develop very strong courage, to develop an ability to have the Dharma, to have the antidotes, to have the teachings arise in our minds rather than have the self-centered thought and all the difficulties arise. And so, really important in doing this, to create the causes. Remember, the Dharma is all about creating the causes. To spend a long time contemplating the faults of self-centeredness, the advantages of cherishing others, the kindness of all sentient beings. If we don't do these steps, if we don't look at the faults of self-centeredness and we don't look at the advantages of cherishing others, the self-centered thought is continually going to come in and undermine our abilities and our efforts. So we really have to understand what it is. We have to understand how it gets in the way of us cherishing and caring for others, and also to see the kindness of others, because it's a stubborn, obstinate, afflicted state of mind that we've had since beginningless time. So we've got to be willing to look at it over and over again. And once again, the key is bringing it back to the difference between the conventional self and the self-centeredness. Because if we say cherish others and neglect ourselves, if we're thinking about the conventional self, I don't know about you, but I'm going to say, no, I'm not going to neglect myself. But if we look at it, caring for the conventional self, the one that wants to generate bodhicitta, the one that has this precious human rebirth, is different than the self-centered thought. We want to neglect the self-centered thought, take care of the sentient being who is trying to learn how to cherish others and generate bodhicitta. Then we can work on this. And motivation is to try to remember the bodhicitta motivation as much as we can. During the beginning of our day, middle of our day, toward the end of our day, no matter what comes up, to just keep remembering. What kind of mind do I want to have? Where am I? How am I feeling? What's going on? What do I truly want this situation to be like? How will it benefit me? How will it benefit the other? To continually just check our motivations. So the next subdivision is cultivating the awakening mind concerned with the interest of others. And this is where we get into the beautiful practice of Tonglen. Tong meaning give, Len meaning take. This is where we are giving our love, our possessions, our virtue, our bodies to all sentient beings. So this is based on exchanging ourselves and others. This is where the rubber hits the road as far as how our practice of exchanging self and others is going with the Tonglen practice. So once again, this is very different than our normal way of thinking. Our normal way of thinking, at least for me, is if there's happiness, yes, please give it to me. If I have suffering, here you go. Thank you very much. Very kind of you. So here we start. And what's different about this is that, and Venerable states it in her commentary here, is that here at the Abbey, in the way that most of us have been taught, is that we've done the taking the suffering first and then giving the happiness. Where in this commentary, Tonglen means giving the happiness first and then taking on the suffering. And Venerable's reason, she feels that it's more effective to start with the taking part when you're taking the suffering, because until you take on others' suffering, giving them happiness doesn't do much for them. So by taking on the suffering, you provide almost a space or an opportunity for them to then reap the benefits of your generosity. But she says other people like it the other way, and it doesn't matter, whatever's most comfortable for you. So then when we begin the Tonglen practice, even before we start it, we've got to think about, well, what does it mean to give, you know, happiness? What is happiness? And for most of us, the first thought is, well, I want to give them all the comforts of this life. I want them to have enough food, clothing, shelter. I want them to have good health, money, vacations, a nice home. So, which is all well and good, but unfortunately those kind of happinesses are short-lived. And so when we want to give the kind of love that's in the Tonglen practice, we want to go deeper, we want to go long-term. We want to wish them to be free of attachment. We want them to be free of the self-centered thought. Can you imagine what a gift to be free of craving, jealousy, the self-grasping ignorance itself. So when we're doing this meditation on love, which is the giving part of the Tonglen, we're thinking about the love that will last, the long-term benefit for sentient beings. And this is the deep, deep love. And that giving our body, our love, our body, possessions, and virtue is part of the bodhisattva practice. This is where the collection of merit is accumulated. This is the method side of the path, and it's the dominant cause for creating the form body of the Buddha, the Rupakaya. So we hear about the Buddha emanating the Sambhogakaya to teach the bodhisattvas and the realized beings, or the Nirmanakaya to come to the world and be in all sorts of bodies, however sentient beings have the karma to receive help. By accumulating the merit from the giving of our body, possessions, and virtue, this is where we accumulate the merit to create the causes to have the form body, to be able to emanate, to be able to give, to manifest as many things, as many times throughout infinite space. So that's the crucial part of the giving of the Tonglen practice. And that's why we give our body away. So, and the other thing is, the other reason why we give our bodies away is that it's not because we hate them, it's not because we have low self-esteem, it's because the self-centered thought obsesses about the body. We have deep, ingrained attachment to the body. We spend a huge part of our lives, and self-centered thought helps us along with this, worrying about the pleasures that the body has, how warm it is, how cold it is, what kind of food it has, how does it look, what do people think about it, how is it dressed, is it too warm, is it too cold? And so by giving the body, we start to work on the self-centered sort of latch onto continually obsessing about the happiness of the body, the pleasures of the body. And so by giving it away and manifesting all these different forms, we sort of we start to work on the fear of eventually, when you get to be a realized bodhisattva, you give your body quite freely without having any type of concern for it. So by practicing it mentally, imagining giving it in these other forms, we sort of give the self-centered thought sort of a closed-door approach, because we're using our body in this beautiful, virtuous way, helping sentient beings rather than obsessing and just being afraid of losing it, afraid of it getting old, afraid of it not getting fed, being warm, whatever. So, and to realize that the attachment to the body is a great source of suffering for us. So the more that we can let it go, and this is one of the great practices, without actually letting it go, we can practice eventually letting it go. And so then, Venerable, once again in her wisdom, we're going to have some of us say, well, I'm doing this visualization of giving my body, but it's not bringing anybody happiness. They're still starving. They're still sick. They're still dying. But what this practice is about is that you're creating the causes to be able to do that. Once again, the Dharma is all about creating causes. And so by doing this practice of giving our bodies over and over again in whatever form, we create the cause to be able to actually do that when we're bodhisattvas and Buddhists, to give it, emanate, manifest as much as without any problem. And so at this point, Nob Kapel inserts some of the beautiful verses of Shantideva's Guide to a Bodhisattva's Way of Life. May I protect those without protection and be a guide leading those upon the path. May I become a vessel, a bridge, and a ship for those who wish to cross over. So this is when we think of giving our bodies to protect those without protection. These are the people who are hungry, children whose parents have been killed, little animals, big animals, all the beings in the world that have a lot of fear, that have this sense of not being safe. So we imagine, you know, emanating these bodies that can protect them, that can take care of them. A guide leading those upon the path. This is so wonderful. This is the one that, and I love this part when Venerable talked about it, is to guide sentient beings who have a kind of spiritual grief, a kind of pain that they experience when you have a deep spiritual yearning, and that you haven't created the atmosphere, the karma, the environment to actually have the Dharma in your life. So you have this kind of loss in your life where you've got a yearning to want to know about all the good things of, well, the good heart, the kind heart, learning about wisdom, but you haven't created the causes, so there's this yearning. To be able to be a guide for those who have the yearning but haven't created the causes, or for people who are going down the wrong path, to be able to point them in a direction which will benefit them in the long term. People who are confused, people who don't have anybody to talk to, so we can become a guide leading those upon the path. May I become a vessel, a bridge, and a ship for those who wish to cross over. And I'm crossing over, I would say crossing over the ocean of samsara, but also a vessel, a bridge. If people need to escape from oppression, may they have refuge, may they have a boat, a helicopter, a plane, a car, may they be able to escape any type of political, military uprisings that are endangering themselves and their family, for, you know, anything that, any kind of transportation that will help sentient beings to be able to escape from fear and from violence. May I be an island for those searching for land and a lamp for those needing a light. May I become a bed for those who need rest and a servant for all who want assistance. So for an island for those searching for land, we turn ourselves into physical elements. So for people, I was thinking of this, when I read this, was thinking about, it was a number of years ago now, and it's still happening, is the boat people, the people who have escaped from Central Asia there, Vietnam, Cambodia, that go in into these little boats not knowing where they were going, just with the shirts on their backs, you know, things like that, to be able to provide them some sanctuary, some safety. A lamp for those needing light. So people with no electricity, people that are frightened, that need a light, any kind, physical light, spiritual light, emotional light, some sort of beacon for people to be able to say, oh, yes, yes, now I see, now I'm not so afraid. Become a bed for those who need rest, for people who are exhausted, people who are sick, people who are homeless. May I become a bed comfortable where they can truly rest and get the rest and recover as best as they can. And that you know they can lay on me, they don't have to say thank you, but may I become that so that it benefits them. And then may I become a servant for all who want assistance. Well, this one I'm not sure about. We don't want to be a servant of anybody. We want other people to wait on us, or trying to make them do what we think that they should do. And we call that helping them. So this is to be a servant without any agenda, to be able to just give assistance to those who need help. Once again, with wisdom, to be able to help them to solve their difficulties and to actualize their potential. Okay. And so the giving continues. And so at this point, giving to those not engaged in the spiritual path. And this is where we imagine emanating ourselves for all the hell beings, the hungry ghosts, humans, animals, gods, demigods, all the beings that have not, that are not able to practice the Dharma in whatever form, due to the level of suffering, like in the hell, hot and cold hells, due to craving, desire that can't be fulfilled, like in the hungry ghost realm, in the animal realm, the beings that are continually eating or being eaten by others. The demigods and gods, jealousy, bliss, sense pleasure, deluxe, are so distracted that they don't even care about the Dharma. For those in the intermediate stage, that they're going to have a rebirth and want to make sure that they have all the causes and conditions and all the benefit possible to make that happen. And so in this point, you just imagine yourself emanating cool waters, delicious food, shady trees, small safe places where animals can hide and nest and have their young. And most important of all is that you imagine yourself being able to manifest as a spiritual teacher, someone who can give the Dharma. So, and to give them all the external conditions that they need. So they'd have the Dharma text, they'd have Dharma friends, they'd have the conducive environment for practicing the Dharma, and they would have a qualified spiritual teacher to guide them. And so you imagine giving yourself in the form of texts, spiritual teachers, conducive environments, Dharma centers, dear friends who care and help them practice well. And also to imagine giving them the 7 Arya jewels: faith, giving, ethical conduct, learning, listening to the teachings, integrity, consideration for others, and wisdom. So imagine giving them all those qualities, so they have the qualities in them, the 3 higher trainings: ethics, concentration, and wisdom. So once again, we're talking about, this is the wisely selfish, is that we're collecting the merit, we're creating the causes to have the form body of the Buddha. And this is one of the ways in which we do it. We mentally imagine now, so we can realistically in future lives, and when Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, be able to actually do this. And then think of, once again, the human beings wishing that they have, the ones that have this great spiritual yearning but have no Dharma teachings, no Dharma groups. They have a human life which is already difficult enough to get, but they haven't created all the freedoms and fortunes. And then when they die, they have what kind of rebirth do you take when you haven't been able to listen to the teachings and create the positive potential to hear them in the future? So to imagine yourself as being able to be the Dharma for them. And then giving to those who harm us. This is generating... Well, we want to give them the necessities of food, clothing, and shelter. We want to be able to manifest the ability to remove from their minds the anger, the ignorance, the jealousy, the resentment, all the afflictions that arise in their minds, to be able to somehow benefit them so that their minds can be calmed, their minds can have peace, their minds can forgive, and... we do our best in every possible way to save them from misery and disaster. And one of the ways in which we, which is helpful in giving to those who have harmed us, is to think that in previous lives we have an immense debt to pay, because in previous lives they have been, we have eaten them, we've used their skins to clothe us, we've gnawed on their bones so they sustained us on a physical level. We have robbed them of their possessions. We've probably tortured them. I mean, that's one of the reasons why they're harming us this life, because we've created the cause and the conditions to have that harm. So one of the ways that we get past that wanting to retaliate is to think of the harm that we have caused them in the past, and to think of the kindness that they have offered to us also in the past. So we imagine giving them the gift that the suffering in their mind ceases, so that their wish to destroy other people's happiness in order to feel good, that that's all pacified, that their mental suffering is pacified, that they don't create the negative karma that comes from harming others. And then the last of the offering, the giving, is to give to those engaged in the spiritual path. So this is from arhats, bodhisattvas, our spiritual teachers, emanating wish-fulfilling bodies and gems to the bodhisattvas, to the arhats, whatever help they need to support their realizations, to support them, even if they're on the last bhumi, whatever they need to be able to manifest for them what they need. And also for our spiritual teachers, emanate countless bodies to help them with their projects, to emanate ourselves as good disciples, where we take their teaching seriously into heart and we do what they tell us to do and practice the way in which they advise us. So just imagine being the disciple that every teacher prays for. That's a great one. Especially when you're feeling kind of... when you're feeling kind of anxious and not sure about how you're doing as a disciple of your teacher, then emanate a disciple that you want to be. And then the last part is the meditation on compassion, which is the taking aspect of Tonglen. So Namkapel spends a lot of time on the giving aspect. And then he goes into the meditation on compassion, which is the giving and taking should be practiced alternately, and you should begin by taking the suffering of yourself. So I know that Venerable has also taught this, is that the best way to start is with ourselves, to take on the suffering of the past, take on our present suffering, take on the suffering of all of our future lives, and take that suffering in the form of, Nam Kapel has them in black heaps like trimmings of hair, but you can also do it as a black piece of coal or something, or smoke or pollution at your heart, and that by taking on your own suffering, what you've experienced, will experience, and take it and just totally obliterating that self-centered thought at the place of your heart. And so you do this for yourself, and then you just work through the different realms. You start with yourself, then you go into the hell beings, you go into taking on their suffering, the hungry ghosts, the humans, the animal realms. And once again, you're just, this is all mental imaging. This is all creativity, using your creativity in a very virtuous way. And just to conjure up these different realms of what would the suffering be like, and what can I do to take that suffering from them? And all that suffering is used is to obliterate the self-centered thought. You're not taking the suffering to take it on so that you can have more suffering. It's all about cultivating compassion, also getting the self-centered thought just out of the way. Without exception, all sentient beings without exception. And so what he suggests, which I found helpful that I've actually done, is that to do this practice without the breath, so doing, imagining the taking, the suffering, the giving of the body, possessions, your virtue, past, present, and future, to do that as a practice for a while without trying to get the breath involved. Because I found when I first started doing Tonglen, I was so concerned about, I was like holding my breath and trying to take on suffering and putting the mental imagery there, and then I'd exhale and then I'd give. So the breath became sort of an obstacle for me trying to do the visualization to where I could do it fairly quickly. So if you can do the breath simultaneously with the visualization, it's great. But if not, get familiar with the practice of this giving and taking first, the images and the feelings that arise by doing it. And then when you're more comfortable with that, then start incorporating the breath. That's one of the suggestions that he has in here. And then these two should be made to ride on the breath. When you have acquired some training in the preceding process, which is giving and taking, then you exhale. Imagine that you are giving your body, possessions, and virtue of the three times to all sentient beings under the sky. And as you inhale, you imagine taking into your heart all the sufferings of every being in the three realms as well as their causes, and that they are completely freed from all of their misery and its causes. And that by doing this, eventually the mind and the breath will flow in the same direction, and you will overcome distraction and strengthen mindfulness. So this is a great mindfulness practice, because you've got to stay really focused on what you're doing. So I wanted to end some of the quotes by Shantideva. And then a final quote on the questions from the Virodhuta Sutra. So from Shantideva, equalize yourself and others, then exchange yourself with others. And having seen the faults of self-centeredness and the ocean of good and concern for others, I shall completely give up all selfishness and accustom myself to accepting others. And whoever is keen to give swift protection to both himself and others should practice the sublime secret of equalizing, exchanging self and others. And if you do not actually exchange your happiness for the suffering of others, you will not become enlightened, nor find any joy in cyclic existence. And therefore, in order to allay harm to yourself and pacify the pain of others, offer yourself in the service of others and protect them as you would protect yourself. And whatever the agonies of sentient beings may they all ripen on me alone. That's from Shantideva. May we all have that realization. And then the last one was from the questions of Virodhuta Sutra. If the merit of generating the awakening mind were to take physical form, it would fill the whole of space and still exceed that. Were someone to fill the Buddha fields with the most precious jewels, numerous as sand grains in the Ganges, and offered them to the protector of the world, and were someone else simply to fold his hands out of respect for the awakening mind, this latter would be the superior offering and its merit would be boundless. Keep that in mind. Out of respect for the awakening mind, simply folding your hands in deep, earnest aspirations. This is where we get to accumulate vast storehouses of merit to attain the form body of the Buddha, and then the wisdom realizing emptiness to attain the wisdom truth body of the Buddha. We can't have just one. We've got to have bodhicitta for the form body of the Buddha and the wisdom realizing emptiness to have the truth body. We need the omniscient mind and we need the ability to manifest out of bodhicitta. So that's it for this evening. Be well, be happy, and may the awakening mind arise quickly in all of our minds.